wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 3rd Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Laurie Mercier talks to Joe Trotter about his important new book, Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. Joe William Trotter Jr. is professor of history and social justice and founder and director of the Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University. Desiree Hellegers reads her recent op-ed, A Love Letter to Pike Place Market. Written for Real Change, Seattle's street newspaper, Desiree reflects on her time in Seattle in response to a developer trying to build a 14-story hotel at the entrance to the Pike Place Market that will essentially destroy one of the most iconic sites in Pacific Northwest, introducing whole new levels of privatized policing and the attending criminalization of the poor and houseless. Bill Resnick talks with Norman Solomon about Bernie, his campaign, the ever-increasing treachery of the Democratic Party establishment, and how, if Bernie were to win the nomination, he would face a conservative Congress, with most Democratic Party congresspeople being moderates sensitive to the needs of capital. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning, and with heavy hearts, we come to you this Monday as we've lost our longtime Old Mole member Clayton Morgridge. He passed away last week. I will reflect on Clayton's contributions to the Old Mole as well as his work in philosophy at Lewis and Clark College and his book, Demystifying Demons. We're saddened and want to wish his family all the best. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO Radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Laurie and Joe Trotter.
Thanks, Denise. Well, we have Joe William Trotter Jr., who is professor of history and social justice and founder and director of the Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy at Carnegie Mellon University. He's the author of a number of publications, including the books Black Milwaukee and Coal, Class, and Color, and he's a past president of the Labor and Working Class History Association. Welcome to KBOO, Joe Trotter.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, let's talk about your important new book, Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America, which I think the title itself tells us much about how essential African-American labor was to the building of the United States. Was that your intention with the title?
Yes. That was several objectives I had in mind with the title, but more so with the book. There are several things that I had hoped to accomplish. And one of those things was to underscore just how important African American workers were to the development of America from the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade.
And I'm also reminded about E.P. Thompson's famous book, The Making of the English Working Class. And it seems to me this is a reminder about how crucial black labor was and is to the American working class.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned E.P. Thompson, because when I was many, many years ago a graduate student trying to find my way into a topic that would really make a contribution to knowledge, I was inspired by that book, because in graduate studies we read Across National Boundaries and E.P. Thompson's The Making of a Working Class in the Context of British History served as a kind of inspiration for me intellectually.
Well, the 1619 Project and a lot of good recent work on the history of capitalism has finally begun to make a public impact, I think, on the understanding of the role of the slave labor system in creating American and global capitalism. Your book not only contributes to that narrative about the origins of capitalism, but it highlights the forgotten role of urban blacks in the making of the American economy. What are some of those early contributions of African Americans to the early American economy?
This is a very good point, and I'm glad you underscored the way in which there's an outpouring of scholarship on this question, but very much of that scholarship does focus on the contributions of blacks in rice, tobacco, cotton, and other agricultural environments and pursuits. But yes, the urban environment, I wanted to underscore that black people were urban people who helped to build the cities from the beginning. And so that many times we perceive blacks as urbanites during the onset of the Great Migration of the 20th century. And so by then, everybody almost can get their arms around the idea that the Great Migration had transformed blacks into a predominantly urban people. But what this book tries to show is that there's another part to the story, and that is African Americans were urban people from the beginning. And at the same time that they were building plantations, clearing land and making way for rice cultivation, cotton, sugar, and so on, they were also building cities that served as great marketing centers for these agricultural products. And so one of the prime contributions that I see African Americans making during this early colonial and early American history is that they were laborers on the building of most of these colonial era cities. And not only in Charleston, New Orleans, and in Baltimore and other southern cities, but they were also contributing as enslaved workers as well as free workers on such cities as New Amsterdam, Boston, and Philadelphia. And so my argument and my documentation highlights how black people as workers played a role in building the national network of cities and not just the regional network of southern cities.
And you show how that early history is important for the building of communities that would emerge in the 20th century. And much of your book focuses on the 20th century. And I think maybe people are more familiar with this massive demographic shift that takes place when the majority of African Americans move from the rural South to urban economies, whether the urban South or the West and Northeast and Midwest.
Exactly.
What was the impact of that movement, not only for increasing possibilities and potential for one's economic standard of living, but also the politics and culture of urban America?
Okay, yes, I'm glad you raised that question, and you jumped to the 20th century, but one of the things that I attempt to do in the book is to show that this 20th century Great Migration and the development of African American life in the 20th century is very much rooted in the changes that took place during the early 19th century, so that the foundation of African American institutional life, and I'm talking about the formal institutional life, where blacks were setting up churches, fraternal orders, businesses of various types, those formative years took place during the antebellum period for many African American communities in the urban North and the South. And so that when the Great Migration opened up and black population exploded in cities, they were not starting from scratch. There were churches that had a long history stretching all the way back to the antebellum period. There were businesses that stretched back, and insurance companies and fraternal orders and so on, that had their genesis in the 19th century. And so that is something that I try to recover, because too often I think we treat the Great Migration against the backdrop of what black life was like in the 20th century rural South. And so our comparison is usually, well, what was life like before black people came to Chicago, before they came to Pittsburgh. And it usually focuses on what life was like in these small southern towns in South Carolina, Alabama, Kentucky, Virginia, and so on. So what this book does is to try to look at the impact of the southern 20th century conditions on stimulating black movement into the cities, but it also tries to show that the phenomenon of black rural to urban migration had deep, deep roots in the early 19th century and also in the 18th century, so that from the beginning of the colonial era, there was a great deal of movement of black people between the cotton, sugar, and tobacco areas into these cities like Richmond, Baltimore, Charleston, New Orleans, Savannah. And so that we have sort of the blueprint, if you will, of the way black people moved historically from rural to urban environment, so that there was not as great a break with the African-American past when we get into the 20th century, as we sometimes like to believe.
Well, along with that kind of continuity, you describe the ways in which employers, white workers, and the state collaborated to erect a racial job ceiling. And certainly this occurs in the 19th century, and it continues into the 20th and 21st centuries.
Very much, yes, exactly. That is a major theme in African-American urban life. Even as African-Americans were contributing to the economy, they were also contributing under duress, under the odds, you know, against the grain, so to speak. Lots of barriers were placed in their way of becoming a viable, free, and independent group of urban dwellers. But I will say this, is that one part of the story is very much about the way they contributed to the building of cities and the nation under pressure and within the context of inequality. But at the same time, I tried to underscore that they were also contributing to the building of their own community, and there they faced additional barriers. But in a way, they were trying to build two cities, the city that was predominantly white and they were excluded from, and at the same time, they were trying to build a city within the context of that exclusion, where they created their own sense of community empowerment and cultural development and interaction.
And
so, yeah, so there's a sort of a layering of issues that I tried to come to grips with in this book.
And it seems like it's from that strength of those communities, as well as the resistance, that you have this very active black labor movement, or African Americans really mobilizing in the workplace, even prior to the 1930s CIO beginning to embrace black workers as key to the organization of all industrial workers.
Right. Yes. I see African Americans, as particularly black workers, as a group who have been in many ways the victims of a lot of misinterpretation of their history. For example, the American Federation of Labor dominated the organized white labor movement following the Civil War through the 1930s, And the stock image of the black worker in those commentaries and studies that privilege the history of the white skilled craftsmen is that black workers were against their own best interest, that they were anti-labor, that they were not interested in organizing collectively and protecting the interests of all workers. So there was this image of black workers as what these white unionists used to call that black people were, quote, a scab race. You know, they would break white stripes, they undermined the labor movement, and they were not a reliable ally in the struggle to really equalize the place of workers in the American economy, particularly the industrial economy. But the truth is from the beginning, almost from the beginning, although even during the antebellum period, black workers were among some of the first people to organize labor unions. And in some cases, they were the ones who really encouraged white workers to organize. And some of those unions took place in the household and domestic service sector, you know, where black workers in New York, for example, on one occasion, they led a strike to bring greater benefits to all hotel workers, including white workers, and in fact played a role in trying to recruit white workers to support an organized labor movement in that field. And so for a long time, black people were written off as being strike breakers. And the image about strike breakers emerged in the context of the late 19th century, when many industries, including steel, meatpacking, and a few other railroads, those industries had unions dominated by the Railroad Brotherhood and also unions of the American Federation of Labor that had exclusionary clauses in their constitution, which said that black people could not be union members. And
well,
so black people had no option.
Well, Professor Trotter, I'm afraid we only have another minute or so, and hate to jump through time so quickly, but given that militancy, just in terms of looking at today, you know, where we have seen so many pundits supposedly analyze the election of Donald Trump as, you know, making generalizations about the working class, which clearly in the minds of these pundits include only white workers. And yet right. We have seen this mobilization of black workers throughout the 20th and 21st centuries and really leading the way, as you point out, in terms of providing much of the resistance to this rightward shift in U.S. politics. And so just in the minute remaining, how would you say we can learn from recent mobilizations of the black working class?
I think it's important to understand that the organization of black workers and their propensity to unionizing is not new. It's a historic development within the history of black people, going all the way back to the 19th century. And so that we can say that there is definitely a strong, continuing, historic thread in the black experience, which says that it's important and right that workers organize collectively and level the playing field when dealing with corporate ownership and employers of labor, and especially in order to bring about greater equity, not only in terms of pay, but in terms of treatment, a role in shaping the workplace.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Joe Trotter, for joining us today on KBOO Radio. And we recommend to everyone the book Workers on Arrival, Black Labor and the Making of America, as essential reading.
Thank you.
I've been down in Pennsylvania, where I was working in the mine. And I've been down in Cincinnati, they laid me off the assembly line. Can't name where I ain't been down, 'cause there ain't no place I ain't been down.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and Professor Joe William Trotter Jr. for that last segment. Later in the program, we'll have Bill Resnick talking to Norman Solomon about Bernie and his campaign and the ever-increasing treachery of the Democratic Party establishment. And I'll conclude today's show with some reflections on Old Mole member, longtime member Clayton Morgridge, who passed away last week. We'll also hear something from the archive by Clayton, something that was near and dear to his heart, trying to find beauty in a world of capitalism. Next up, we have Desiree Hellegers, who reads her recent op-ed, A Love Letter to Pike Place Market. Desiree.
When I moved to Seattle in 1984, I landed my first job in the Pacific Northwest as live-in staff at Sacred Heart Shelter on Queen Anne Hill. The job didn't pay much, but that didn't matter a whole lot to me. because I'd fallen head over heels in love. From the first moment I laid eyes on it, I was in love with Pike Place Market. The iconic red neon sign and clock face, the fishy smell that wafted up from the fish vendors tossing their wares and calling out like carnival barkers, the cobblestone streets, the palpable sense of history, and behind it all, that staggering, timeless, watery blue backdrop of sound. More than any other space in the city, the market was and still is a magnetic creative commons, a microcosm of the city where a diverse cross-section of humanity congregates and finds community, and where on even the thinnest of dimes, you can still wander among artisans, artists, and activists, soaking up songs from musicians busking on the corners. And among that diverse sea of humanity was and is the city's houseless, among them indigenous people who have struggled through waves of removal to keep a foothold on their ancestral lands. For decades at least, the market has been a space where houseless and low-income people were welcome, where they could congregate, check out the art, or practice their own, and rest without being continually criminalized, harassed, and swept out. But that rich tradition is now under threat from the plan to demolish the historic Hahn Building at First and Pike and replace it with a 14-story hotel. The Hahn Building, which dates back to the 1880s, is also home to the Green Tortoise Hostel, which at $35 a night is a precious resource for low-income travelers. The good news is that on January 20th, a group calling itself Save the Market Entrance filed an appeal to stop the construction based on a host of adverse anticipated impacts that the Seattle Design Review Board failed to take into account, including increased traffic and parking congestion and safety threats for pedestrians and bicyclists. The appeal also notes that the Hahn has recently been nominated for a landmark designation and that the proposed building is an out-of-scale modern glass tower that will destroy this culturally important intersection in Seattle, diminishing the cultural experience for millions of visitors who come to Pike Place Market every year. Thousands of letters and emails have been submitted in defense of the Hahn and the market, many of them love letters of sorts by people who cannot fathom the prospect of sacrificing the rich historic architecture and community of the market to yet another sterile high-rise. The 14-story hotel would, moreover, privatize a good section of the Sound View, offering it up as the exclusive purview of the hotel's paying customers. The hotel, with its well-heeled clientele, would no doubt also come with private security guards, who, with guidance from the developers/owners, would also have their own ideas about how the market should be policed, who belongs, and who needs to move along. In this respect, the hotel fundamentally endangers the identity of the market as a space where people of all socioeconomic backgrounds can mingle and feel welcome. Joe Martin, co-founder of the Pike Place Medical Clinic and a frequent Real Change contributor, feels strongly about the importance of preserving the Hahn. While Martin strongly supports the fight to preserve the Showbox Theater, he believes the historic significance of the Hahn surpasses that of the Showbox, which is a half block away on First and was recently awarded landmark status. Quote, First Avenue was part of the historic Skid Row community that dates back decades and decades. The Hahn is a vestige, part of that character, part of that history, unquote. And like it or not, the connection to that history and to the diverse cross-section of humanity that finds community at the market against the watery blue backdrop of the Sound is what continues to draw millions of tourists to the city annually. In the 1960s, as the Seattle Times has reported, architect and future city council member Victor Steinbrück helped mobilize a grassroots campaign that gained support from student activists to preserve the market when it was similarly under assault from developers. They did it then, and we can do it now. Even if you live in Oregon, if you love the Pike Place Market and don't want to see it sacrificed to the highest corporate bidder, help keep the pressure on. Call Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin and the Seattle City Council and tell them to broaden the landmark designation beyond the Showbox to the Hahn. The mayor's number is 206-684-4000. And while you're at it, why not take a few minutes also to contact Market View Place Associates and Stellar Holdings, the developer, and tell them what you think of their plans to pave and privatize Paradise. If you love the market, now's the time to show it. The number for Stellar Holdings is 425-576-8800. That's 425-576-8800. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Thank you, Desiree. Next up, we've got Bill Resnick talking to Norman Solomon about Bernie and his campaign, the treachery of the Democratic Party that apparently is stepping up their tactics to keep Bernie from getting the nomination. So let's hear what they have to say about Bernie and his chances of defeating the conservative Democratic Party establishment.
Hi, Norman Solomon. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill.
Norman Solomon is a local boy made good, worked in his youth on the never-to-be-forgotten, at least by me, Portland Alliance, the Radical Monthly, and also here at KABU. Norman now resides in Northern California, San Francisco, near San Francisco, has become a national figure, the founder of the organization Roots Action. He also writes a great deal, now 12 books, a vast trove of op-ed. His analyses appear in near every left journal and website that I look at. So, Norman, today, it's Saturday. We're pre-recording this interview. Next Monday is the 3rd when Portland hears this interview. It's also the day of the Iowa presidential primary election. You're an enthusiastic, proud, hopeful supporter of the Sanders Revolution. In 2016, you were a Sanders delegate to the Democratic Party National Convention, and you're now the coordinator of the Independent Bernie Delegates Network. So, Norman, what do you expect in Iowa and then New Hampshire, where you spent the last month? And then we can get to how Bernie can become the Democratic Party candidate for president, how Trump can be beaten, and whether Bernie can govern in the face of furious opposition from the media, from corporate America, and from a right wing. But first, what's happening out there in voter land, and how can Bernie win?
Well, my crystal ball is in the shop, but I think he has a very strong chance in Iowa and New Hampshire. I was in New Hampshire just for a few days in early fall, and by the way, I'm headed back there almost imminently. But I think it's very important that the grassroots has overcome tremendous barriers, not so much this time the Democratic National Committee, as the national media, the corporate media, and in terms of ideology and content, that includes programs on ostensibly public broadcasting, like All Things Considered and Morning Edition and NPR, as well as PBS NewsHour. This is not unanimous in terms of all the coverage, but the dominant media themes and approach to commentary and supposed news coverage of Bernie is negative. It's critical. And yet I think that the tremendous upsurge of support, which is challenging oligarchy, which is really looking towards a Green New Deal, including Medicare for All, it's generational and it's ideological. And it's the outpouring of response to the neoliberal model, which, Bill, I know you've talked about on this show many times over the years. So as the saying goes, I'm cautiously optimistic, but it depends on what people around the country do from the grassroots.
Yeah, it appears from the rules that if Bernie doesn't win on the first ballot, the Democratic Party grandees get to vote, 700 of them or so, in the second ballot. Do you expect, even if Bernie has the most delegates, he can win on the first ballot?
Well, on the one hand, there has not been a second ballot since 1952. When Adlai Stevenson was first nominated. At the same time, there are still a few candidates with some significant momentum and capacity, apparently, to get delegates. I think if Bernie were to arrive at the convention in July with a majority of delegates, more than a few above 50%, he's going to be nominated. As you alluded to, the rules change, which was for the better compared to 2016, is that superdelegates cannot vote at all in the first ballot. But there's, I think, a very real danger that if there's no majority for any candidate in the first ballot, then it would be a huge blow to the Bernie campaign because the superdelegates are, with few exceptions, not going to support Bernie. They're members of Congress who are Democrats, other elected officials around the country. There are quite a few lobbyists thrown in from the Democratic National Committee. So it makes it all the more important in a county, one after the other around this country, in a state like Oregon, crucial that there be sufficient organizing to get enough delegates for Bernie.
Yeah, the Bernie army is, it seems to me, is an incredible phenomenon. It's happening all over the country. I hope they're sufficiently activated not just to win the primary, but to win primaries by a big enough margin and win the Democratic nomination, but then be able to challenge Trump and the right-wingers. We'll get to that. Let's get back to the presidential election if Bernie were to win. My sense is that he would be really certainly the best candidate for undermining Trump, for pointing out Trump's weaknesses. He's got a wonderful style on the stump, I think, that would appeal to lots and lots of people who voted for Trump in the 2016 election. What's your sense?
I think that's true. If you look at the pivotal states, and let's face it, there's a maximum a dozen states, which would be the differential, the swing states, and the crucial big ones being the ones that went for Trump in 2016. Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, shouldn't have happened, must not happen in 2020. And in contrast to Bernie, say Joe Biden, who supported NAFTA, would be poison in terms of a general election campaign because NAFTA is poison in those upper Midwest industrial states that were so damaged by the race to the bottom, the export of jobs from NAFTA. And Biden supported NAFTA and similar type of corporate-friendly trade deals. Bernie has always opposed them. And so I think that it's often overlooked by the, so to speak, liberal intelligentsia and corporate media. Whether they want to overlook it or not is another question. But the fact that Bernie is so well-positioned to do really well in those states is very important. That said, I mean, this would be a huge battle. This is ideological. It is class war. I wrote a piece that was on Common Dreams and other sites about a week ago where I started out by talking about the fact that in 1968, literally thousands of young people volunteered for Eugene McCarthy in New Hampshire primary, propelled by opposition to the Vietnam War. And now, here in 2020, there are thousands of young supporters who have been activated, mostly who live in New Hampshire, motivated by the class war, the fact that there is a class war going on which is more and more brutal towards the youngest generations, people who can't pay their college debts, who find that their opportunities, yes, are there for low-paying jobs with little sense of improving their own financial stability or raising a family or that sort of thing. So we have opportunities, but also huge barriers because Wall Street and broader corporate America are dead set against Bernie Sanders, and to a significant degree, not as much, but significantly against Elizabeth Warren as well. It's an irony, Bill, that the mass media really have always, in the last year or so since Biden put his toe in the water and then jumped in the race, always said how Biden is the most electable and how he would really draw in the votes. Well, for one thing, if you look, even set aside ideology and content for just a moment, I was recently looking at footage of Biden 16, 18 years ago. And while he was vile and the most important Democrat, for instance, as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to push this country into war on Iraq, he was fluid. He was fluent when he spoke. He was able to put together one sentence after another without stumbling. He can't do that now unless he's at a teleprompter or doing like a totally rote stump speech. He's clearly lost a few steps, and his coherence as well as his veracity or sorely lacking. And then you look at his record, which is abominable as a Democrat who has always been willing to reach across the aisle to Republicans, meet them halfway or more, often urge cutting Social Security, someone who has supported one war after another, somebody who fought for the notorious now crime bill of 1994, used racial code words and phrases racist code words and phrases, aligned overtly, we now know from released documents, letters to some of the most vile racist segregationists to fight busing for school integration in the 1970s. So, you know, add all that up, his record is such that there will not be, if he is nominated, heaven forbid, a capacity, I think, to get the kind of turnout for marginalized, politically marginalized people that is essential. People of color and young people have to be inspired, or we will lose this election to Trump.
This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, interviewing Norman Solomon. His domain is U.S. politics, domestic and foreign policy. He writes a great deal on the web, not only on the web, in magazines. We've been discussing the Sanders campaign that Norman Solomon strongly supports. He's the coordinator of the independent organization, the Bernie Delegates Network. He'll be active at the Democratic Party convention. We've been talking about Bernie's chances of winning with the Bernie army behind him, and also critiquing the record of Joe Biden, whose policy positions are very clear. The audio is good and the TV productions are good, and he becomes an impossible candidate for responding to Trump and appealing to the millions of people who deserted Obama for Trump. Norman, let's talk about, can Bernie govern? The New York Times and the Washington Post are producing article after article critiquing Bernie. And CNN and MSNBC, the sort of semi-liberal stations, most of their anchors and interviewers are also anti-Bernie. They argue that Bernie can't govern. And in fact, it's really very hard for a person with Bernie's commitments to deal with the opposition, not only from people in his party, like Corbyn in England was sabotaged by the right wing of the Labour Party with claims of his anti-Semitism. It was bizarre, actually, that that trope could succeed. But Bernie's going to face the same problem, and he's also going to face the same problem that Milt Wilson and Mitterrand and Allende and numerous left figures have faced. When the capitalists, the major employers and anchors of the economy all over the United States, when they decide not to invest, called capital strike, how to deal with that opposition? There's also the right wing, who will be in the streets as they were in Venezuela and everywhere in the world when a left-wing government takes over. There's huge efforts at disruption, sometimes supported by police. I don't believe that that's too alarmist. Anyway, Norman, how to deal with those questions for a Sanders presidency and administration?
I hope we get to that set of problems. It's a long way from here to there, to the inauguration of President Bernie Sanders. But hypothetically and hopefully, if we get there, then I think a lot of what you allude to is very much on the horizon. And it would be a need for a huge grassroots upsurge that is sustained to give Bernie support and his administration support. I believe that's why during one of the debates last year, in I think an extraordinary moment, when each candidate was given a chance to have a 1 minute or so sum up at the end of the debate, Bernie did not do the usual thing about, I'm so great, vote for me, here's my website, you know, sum up sort of thing. Instead, he went right into, we're not going to solve these problems we've been discussing unless millions of people organize from the grassroots with an unprecedented movement to take power away from the oligarchs, from corporate interests, from Wall Street and the billionaire class. And I think he was referring to exactly what you were saying, Bill, in the sense that he recognizes fully that it's not about simply getting somebody in office. It's about changing the political climate and the zeitgeist of how people behave at the grassroots. And when you think about somebody who on the surface had a completely different background, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, grew up rich was not progressive in his career of decades before he entered the White House. You see, still in all, how important and crucial it was that you had an emerging labor movement, you had progressives of many stripes on the left who made possible the New Deal. So we need that combination, and that's where, whether people live in the Pacific Northwest or anywhere else in this country, drawing on the traditions of and enlivening in the current time, progressive organizing is just going to be absolutely crucial.
That's really a great place to end this interview. We'll be talking to you a lot more in the future about the primary process and what's happening around the country, and then, in fact, in the Democratic Party convention, which is in Milwaukee, my hometown. In fact, I may even visit it during that period, say hello to a few old friends. Norman Solomon, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, KBOO.
That's Alice Cooper, "I Want to Be Elective." If only Alice Cooper could be elected, that could be fairly interesting. Thank you, Bill and Norman Solomon. Well, as the world turns, we moles have heavy hearts this morning as we produce our first show since the death of our dear friend and comrade, Clayton Morgridge. Clayton had been with the Old Mole for more than 20 years, writing philosophical commentaries on capitalism that challenged assumptions about human nature and its possibilities, arguing that humans are relational beings and exposing how desires are blunted by capitalist ideology. Clayton's contributions to the Old Mole Collective, however, were many. He was very instrumental in moving the moles forward as we began to archive the show and enter the world of podcasts, developing our website, webpage on the KBOO site, and creating host portraits and biographies. And Clayton took also a leadership role, co-creating our collective-specific Old Mole Handbook, something that was probably largely overdue. But he, as well as collective members, got these things done, and he was always a reliable comrade and stepping in to fill the gaps and right the ship as needed. His legacy as an Old Mole will live with us, and his friendship and dedication will certainly be missed. Alongside Clayton's uncompromising critique of capitalism was his dedication to art and music as essential to any new society, the renewal of human capacity for cooperation and the appreciation and protection of our natural world, something he believed must be wrestled away from capitalist exploitation. I want to play a piece here that was originally aired in July 15, 2019. It's a very wonderful example of the work that Clayton did. It's called "Why Capitalism is Blind to What is Beautiful and Worth Loving and What to Do About It." In this commentary, Clayton Morgridge shows how some philosophers reduce the world to the totality of facts and regard all feelings as subjective, with nothing to say about reality. Capital even goes further, reducing all value to the value of money. Let's have a listen.
"Just the facts, ma'am, is what Sergeant Friday, played by Jack Webb, used to say on the old police show Dragnet. He said this to witnesses when investigating a crime in order to head off their emotional reactions to what they had seen or their speculation about causes and motives. Some philosophers, logical positivists in particular, put forward the idea that the real world consists only of facts, that our feelings about the world are merely subjective and have no bearing on truth, except perhaps truths about human psychology. Facts are objective and real. Feelings are subjective and not real in any way that counts. But what could be more real than the tension in a difficult relationship, or the love between people in love, or between parents and their children? Try to convey these feelings and the way they shape what goes on between people in purely factual terms. Here's another thing whose reality is undeniable, that would not even exist except for what goes on within us. Describe what you've just heard in objective, factual terms. You could describe the sounds in great detail as wave patterns in the air. You could discuss the pitches and the tempos. But what makes what you heard music is what happens within us as we hear those sounds. When we listen to music with full appreciation, we let the rhythms and melodies play through our bodies. We ourselves become part of the music. We are moved by it. Apart from our feeling it, music is nothing. Without listeners, music would be mere sound and fury, signifying nothing. Music stirs us to our depths, engaging our emotions, and even the emotions we don't have names for. The same is true of the visual arts. They are made to be seen by living human beings who respond deeply in their bodies and souls to what they see. But isn't this true of the whole world we live in and are part of? We respond to the world not just as terrain we must find our way around in and manipulate to give us what we need. If we are fully alive, we are always responding to what is going on around us aesthetically and emotionally, with hope, fear, desire, disgust, love and hate, and whatever emotion we are expressing when we say, "That's beautiful." The world would not be the world we know if it were not for the complex feelings involved in our encounter with it, any more than a Bob Dylan song or Beethoven's Fifth Symphony would be what we know them to be if we did not respond to them as we do. Nor, of course, would Dylan or Beethoven have created them. Yet it is not only philosophers like the logical positivists who can be seduced by the idea that the real world consists of nothing but facts that are entirely independent of human feelings. In fact, this idea is like a defense mechanism many of us employ to get along in a capitalist society. Why? Well, because capital has but one way of thinking about and acting in the world, and that is to expropriate and exploit it, to turn it into a singular unit of value, namely money. Bankers and landlords cannot see breathing living men and women and children. with needs for safe shelter. Health insurance and pharmaceutical companies cannot really see the injured and the sick. Apple and Amazon cannot see the human beings that work for them. Capital can see only sources of income and units manufactured and delivered. Capital can see nothing it can care for except opportunities for growth. Everything on earth becomes a resource for the production of profit. Forests, prairies, mountains, rivers and oceans, and all the living beings in them are fodder for the capitalist machine that chews it all up and excretes one substance, money. So when we look at our world, including each other, from within the system of capitalism, what is most real is just the facts. By what machinery and at what cost can oil be extracted from this or that seabed? And what is its value on the market? How many hours can we employ these workers at what wages to maximize our profits? How much timber can be cut in this old-growth forest? At what cost and what return on investment? Just the facts, ma'am, and don't give me irrelevant subjective feelings about the natural world or the quality of people's lives. Yes, the beauty of the world and the love that people have for each other, those are fine for leisure time and vacation, as long as they don't get in the way of production. The world that consists of facts and just the facts, the world is conceived by logical positivism and seized and governed by capital, is a thin, cold, and colorless world. It is like music that evokes no pleasure, human life without passion, a tale told by an idiot, lacking even sound and fury, and signifying nothing but death. It is a world where the impulse to love struggles to find anything worth loving, or anything to call beautiful, where our desire for love must be content with the imaginary realms of fiction, art sequestered in museums, and nature fenced off in preserves. Capitalism would blind us to everything that could evoke our love and our pleasure, to most of what impels us to say, "That's beautiful." The movement to do away with capitalism and to reconstruct the world, to make the world our world, a human world, is underway and needs our support and active participation. There is a world beyond the world of facts that we can cultivate together, guided by our desire for what can be loved because it is beautiful. I am Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Clayton. Clayton Morgridge taught philosophy at Lewis and Clark for 40 years, and in his retirement, he wrote a wonderful book titled Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. Clayton had this to say about his accomplishment. In the recent years since I retired from teaching, I have completed a book titled Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. Its purpose is to survey the territory of the unconscious, where our inner demons lie. And to do this for readers without previous background in psychological or philosophical theory. It proposes a way of thinking about our souls, psyches, that is broadly psychoanalytic, but that remains closer to our ordinary experience than other presentations of psychoanalysis. The book is also more user-friendly than explanations based on brain science. It is addressed directly to people who are disturbed by renegade thoughts and feelings, inner demons, they do not understand or control. I first met Clayton Morgridge in the late 80s when I took a class at the Red Rose School. Clayton's course was titled Bourgeois Ideology, with the course materials printed on a Ditto machine, and I still have those course materials and probably will refer to them once again soon. and it took just one class for Clayton to advance my thinking with a swift but kind rebuke of my Western lens. And I needed it. I was young and a little bit uncivilized in my politics, but his kindness and his care was immeasurable at that point in my life and development, and I will and have always remembered him for that. Here is what Clayton had to say about his teaching. Quote, "My aim in teaching is to find ways to ensnare the minds of students in the endlessly rewarding pathways of philosophical perplexity. Philosophy is a lifelong journey in which confusion and enlightenment are constantly succeeding each other, with each moment of enlightenment outshining the one before it." And that was Clayton. He will be missed. He will be always with us at the Old Mole, as his contributions will be in us and around us. I wish Clayton Morgridge rest in peace and all the best to his family and friends. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour, and we're gonna just close it out right now with the silky, silky voice of our dear friend Clayton Morgridge.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole.